there's a certain metaphor and a certain symbolic way of explaining the issue in these verses, and usually they have two meanings. One is that Allah is talking about His ultimate power, His ultimate knowledge, His ultimate might, that He is so powerful that if He wanted to, He could guide and whoever He wants to guide. And on the other hand, He has the power to not guide whoever He does not want to guide. So it's talking about the ultimate power of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, not necessarily meaning that Allah forces somebody to do these things, but rather Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam says that he is explaining the ultimate power, that yes, if God wanted to, that He could do these things, guide whoever He wants or misguide whoever He wants if He wanted to, because He has the power to do so, but out of Allah's justice, He does not punish an individual if he has misguided them. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Sometimes we see that, attitude. We realize, you look at the whole story of shaitan, right at the beginning. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala told the assembly of malaika, where shaitan, being a jinn, still had elevated to a status where he was there. And he was included in the command of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to do sajda to Adam. And what does he say? He said, Allah, I have worshipped you for years and years and years. And I will only do sajda to you and no one else. Maybe a person, a human being will say, oh, he's such a loyal, servant of me. Doesn't want to do sajda to anyone but me. And what does Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala say? He was banished. And he became mal'oon. Why? Because the whole idea of worshipping Allah and being obedient to Him is to be obedient the way He wants us to obey Him. Not according to my own standard. I can't get up one day, and feeling well. Now that Allah has given me total shafa, today instead of 2 rakat fajr, I will do it 4 rakat. No, that namaz will be rejected and become batil. I can do my 2 rakat fajr namaz and do maybe 2 extra as a sunnah, shukr for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But I can't change the way Allah wants me to do things. And so when we talk about rukhsat, wherever Allah has given us the rukhsat, and rukhsat means what? He has given us the convenience, okay, do it this way easily. When we talk about traveling these days, people come and say, maybe those laws about traveling, fasting and traveling was for the days of camels, not the when we have aeroplanes. It's so easy for us. It's not an issue of being easy and hard. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَمَنْ كَانَ عَلَىٰ سَفَرٍ Surah Baqarah. Whoever is traveling or not feeling well, then they fast the other days. Whether it is the days of the Prophet, when they travel by camel or the planes, it doesn't make any difference. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given us that convenience. And to reject that convenience is actually to insult Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir /en/call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
During the second day of his official visit, the Iranian president displayed a keen focus on strengthening cultural bonds with Pakistan. Traveling to Lahore, a city with rich cultural heritage, President Raisi was warmly welcomed upon his arrival by the Chief Minister of Punjab, Maryam Nawaz. He paid homage at the mausoleum of the revered Urdu and Persian poet Allama Muhammad Iqbal. Iqbal is held high esteem in Iran for his poetic works in the Persian language and is lovingly called Iqbal-e-Lahori by the Iranians. President Raisi emphasized that there was no sense of foreignness in Pakistan, underlining the deep historical and cultural connections between the two nations. President Raisi offered special prayers for the oppressed people of Gaza and lauded the Pakistani nation for its unwavering unity in championing the rights of oppressed people of Palestine. Meanwhile, the president paid a visit to the renowned University of Lahore and delivered a speech. In his address, President Raisi emphasized the deep historical, religious, cultural, and civilizational bonds between Pakistan and Iran. Raisi also said the common point of view of the people of Iran and Pakistan is the defense of the oppressed Palestinian nation. He asserted that the Islamic Republic will continue to defend the resistance and oppressed nation of Palestine with pride. President Raisi also warned that if Israel makes a mistake and attacks Iran's territory, it is clear that nothing will be left of the Israeli regime. Later, during consecutive meetings with the Chief Minister and Governor of Punjab, the Iranian President reassured Pakistani authorities of Tehran's commitment to collaborating in bolstering cultural and trade relations between the two nations.
President Raisi has devoted his second day of Pakistan visit to exploring the country's rich cultural heritage. Many believe that the Iranian President's trip will significantly contribute to boosting the bilateral trade and strengthening cultural relations between the two nations. Nasir Kazmi, Lahore.
Dozens of organizations marched in Paris against Islamophobia and racism as Israel's attempted genocide and ethnic cleansing has caused increased state-sponsored repression against Europe's largest Muslim community. A main theme of the march was protecting children. Since October 7th, children as young as 10 years old have been charged with so-called apology for terrorism, while a child of 8 was falsely targeted for praying during recess. Scandals like those have many saying that non-white children are no longer being treated like children, but instead like suspected fanatics, delinquents, and full-grown adults.
We Muslims are enduring so much Islamophobia these days, and it's not like there wasn't a lot of Islamophobia in France already. The targeting of our children is a step too far, and it's incredible that they have taken this shameful step.
As France is accused of targeting Muslim children at home, their elite are giving military and political cover to Israel's mass murder in Gaza of an estimated 15,000 children and the orphaning of some 20,000 others.
It's totally unjust how we are watching murder, torture, and the bombing of embassies, and nobody is allowed to say anything. We're here to say, stop the violence against Palestinian and Iranian people.
A decade ago, during another Israeli invasion of Gaza, France became the first country to ever ban pro-Palestinian demonstrations. They banned pro-Palestinian demonstrations for a month after the counterattack by Hamas on October 7th, handing out hundreds of thousands of euros in fines and making mass arrests. Police initially banned this march, claiming it was a threat to public order and possibly anti-Semitic. That was overturned at the last moment, but many say the effort is proof of a long-running double standard against non-whites and non-Jews.
C'est des antisémites. Ça, c'est n'importe quoi.
Anytime there is a march about Palestine or Islamophobia, the interior minister in whatever administration seeks to ban it. The idea that we are anti-Semitic is total nonsense. I get the feeling that I'm more French than many others who aren't of Algerian descent as I am, because many have totally abandoned the longtime values of French political culture.
Similar to during France's 2-year state of emergency starting in November 2015, many have been shocked by the lack of outcry at this latest targeting of the Muslim community, despite perpetual bragging of being the alleged birthplace of human rights. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
After almost 3 days, the Israeli forces withdrew from the refugee camp of Nur Shams near the city of Tul Kerem in northern occupied West Bank. Only then paramedics were able to evacuate the martyrs' bodies and the families were able to count their dead. Over a dozen Palestinians have been killed since Thursday, but the number might be higher, as reports suggest that Israeli forces had confiscated the bodies of more martyrs. On Sunday, a comprehensive general strike was declared across the occupied West Bank to mourn Tul Kerem martyrs. Scores of Palestinians also held a protest in the center of Ramallah against Israel's escalation and violence in Tul Kerem and Nur Shams refugee camp.
Israel is expanding its genocide into the West Bank as well. And as we said before, there is no safe place for any Palestinian. And there has to be immediate Palestinian unity to stand up to this terrible aggression. And there has to be international boycott, divestment, sanctions campaign worldwide. And there has to be condemnation.
It's obvious that the Palestinian people, leadership and factions have to declare an immediate comprehensive popular uprising all over the Palestinian territories until the Israeli occupation ends. The ongoing war of attrition is no longer useful, but what's necessary is a national popular uprising.
The Israeli invasion has caused some of the worst destruction in the West Bank in decades. The occupation forces destroyed infrastructure, including sewage lines, shops, homes, and vehicles. Homes were turned into interrogation centers, and dozens of Palestinians were arrested. According to locals, heavy exchange of fire and clashes took place between resistance fighters and Israeli soldiers during the operation. The Israeli military admitted that at least 9 of its soldiers were wounded.
The Israeli occupation regime is escalating its violence against the Palestinian people. Its crimes are meant to exterminate the Palestinian people. In Gaza, genocide is being committed, and here in the West Bank, there are daily incursions, murders, collective punishment, and destruction everywhere. The Israeli occupation is doing its utmost to either bring Palestinians to their knees or commit more aggression and crimes against them.
Sunday's general strike paralyzed all aspects of life in the West Bank, with shops, schools, universities, and banks shuttered. But Palestinians question whether such a standstill is enough, expressing fear that once the Israeli military is done with Gaza, the occupied West Bank could be next. The Israeli military's violence against Palestinians is aimed at countering resistance, people here say. This is part of the Israeli crackdown on armed groups in the occupied West Bank. However, Palestinians say the Israeli crimes, including in the Nur Shams refugee camp, have failed to weaken their determination. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
At
two-day international forum dubbed What Future for Palestine kicked off in Rome on Saturday. The initiative, organized by an opposition group called Front of Dissent, has been put together to tackle different topics, namely Zionism, its impact on Palestine and West Asia, the nature of Israel, what changes for the Palestinian resistance after October 7, West Asia in its transition to a multipolar world, and the risk of the Ukraine war escalating into a global conflict. The conference was attended by citizens who are very concerned about the turn the situation has taken in Western countries.
Today's forum is an important attempt to break down the wall of silence surrounding Zionist wrongdoings in West Asia. It is appalling how our mainstream media are covering Israel's brutal war in Gaza. They have created a parallel world and a parallel truth with the aim of covering up the bad things Israel is doing.
The superpowers that support Zionism are former colonial powers, most of them. And they had a role in creating Zionism in the first place. Many people allowed the Zionists to really empower themselves. So they were originally empowered by people who probably had a sense of guilt about the Holocaust, but eventually they became so powerful that they are able to control so many media outlets. They are able to control many politicians.
Speakers at the conference included former diplomats, politicians, journalists, and activists from several countries, including China, the US, Britain, Russia, and many others. Video links were also established with the spokesman for the worldwide anti-Zionist religious group, Neturei Karta International. Analysts at the conference are saying that the aftershocks of the Gaza crisis triggered by Israeli genocidal war are highly likely to reach far beyond West Asia and the Africa region. With the US credibility as a regional security guarantor shot to pieces, West Asia might see increased diplomatic engagement from China and Russia.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan received the head of the Hamas Political Bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, in Istanbul. During the meeting that lasted for more than 2.5 hours, the two sides discussed the Israeli aggression on Gaza, ways and measures to ensure uninterrupted and sufficient delivery of humanitarian aid to Gaza, and the lasting peace in the West Asia region. During the meeting, President Erdogan stated that amid ongoing tensions in the region, it is important to keep the world's attention on Gaza and not allow the Israeli regime to achieve political gains from its standoff with Iran. In a statement published by the Turkish presidency, Erdogan said, "It is vital that Palestinians act with unity in this process. The strongest response to Israel and the path to victory lie in unity and integrity."
Today's meeting was very important for both Turkey and Hamas to set ground for the upcoming changes. We all know now Qatar is hosting Hamas Bureau and leaders as well as playing the role of mediator in negotiations with Israel. While there is a pressure from Washington for Hamas to leave Qatar, and there is the question of where will Hamas go now, we know that the relation of Hamas and Syria is getting better, and it already has a good relation with Iran. But I don't think they are a choice, and for that, Turkey will be the best option.
Analysts say Turkey will not only be hosting Hamas movement leaders and bureau, but will also take the lead in mediating to reach a lasting solution for the Palestinian-Israeli conflict.
Turkey is trying to play a very important role that is bigger than working on reaching a ceasefire in Gaza. It is rather solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and trying to reach a lasting solution. The 7th of October was a turning point to start working on reaching a lasting solution, and I think Turkey's role is a key for it, to maintain good relations with all sides.
Hamas had an office in Turkey since 2011, and Turkey mediated in exchange of prisoners. Turkish president maintains warm relations with Haniyeh and says he will always defend the Palestinian cause. Today's meeting takes place against the backdrop of Qatar potentially stepping back from ceasefire talks. This development could create a vacancy that Ankara is well positioned to fill, given Turkey's established relations, particularly with the Hamas movement. which many view as a strategic advantage. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
According to the Palestinian Ministry of Health, more than 70% of the fatalities of the brutal Israeli aggression against the Gaza Strip are children and women. Likewise, according to reports issued by the Euro-Mediterranean Center for Human Rights, women and children in Gaza are enduring displacement, death, pain, and suffering in a way that the human mind cannot bear. More than 80% are living in tents without the minimum basic needs to live, without water, without food, with a chilling cold. The current situation is pushing them to the limit, making it impossible to focus on anything but survival.
Today, innocent civilians are placed in inhumane conditions which do not possess the most basic requirements for human survival. When it comes to children and women, the suffering becomes more painful because women's needs are greater. Women today live in tents. There is no bathroom. There is no toilet. They cannot take care of themselves. They have to stand in long lines in front of men's bathrooms, and this means double suffering. Also, do not forget pregnant women or those who gave birth during the attack. We're talking about an aggression that affects all vital aspects.
Pregnant women and those who have given birth in the midst of war are one of the most affected groups. Similarly, the United Nations Population Fund estimated that since the beginning of the Israeli aggression on the Gaza Strip, approximately 60,000 women are pregnant, and of them, 5,500 would give birth soon, many of them by cesarean section. This means that terrible hospital sanitary conditions, as well as the food crisis, will endanger their lives and the lives of newborn babies.
Pregnant women are suffering from extreme cold, food shortages and medicine shortages. We have noticed an increase in the rate of spontaneous abortions, an increase in the rate of premature births, and an increase in cases of small fetuses. Pregnant women leave the hospital about 10 hours after giving birth and go to the tents, where they have no means of living. Newborn babies are exposed to many diseases. We have observed that a large percentage of these women return to the hospital with their children who have caught a cold, and some have also died.
The lack of hygiene and high levels of malnutrition experienced in overcrowded refugee camps are a poisonous mixture. According to the World Food Program, there is a high risk of famine, and cases of dehydration and malnutrition are increasing rapidly. Many mothers say they only eat once a day to survive. However, there are children who have stopped talking or eating because of what they have seen and experienced. Others cry and scream with every loud sound they hear. Months of war have traumatized an entire generation of children.
You see the atmosphere. Making bread is suffering. To go to the bathroom, you have to wait in line. To get water and foods, you also have to wait in line. That is, our entire life is suffering. In the tent where I live, there are approximately 8 people and my daughter, her husband, and her daughter as well. That is 13 people in just 9 square meters. We have to make the bread here, you see, and if we don't find cardboard to light the fire, we can't bake the bread. We only have 1 bottle of water a day and food. If they give us help, we eat. And if they don't give us food, no, because the price of goods is multiplied by 10.
The suffering we experience as children is that we have been forced out of our homes. Our houses were bombed when we were inside it. My friend, who was my cousin, has died. All my friends have died, and I have no one left. Our childhood has been stolen from us. I want to go back to my house. I want the war to end and return home so I can rest.
Gazans continue to call for Israel to fulfill its obligations under international humanitarian law, which begins with the protection of civilian lives. They assure that all they want is the end of this nightmare full of death and pain. Palestinian women have always been the symbol of the strong law of resistance. However, displacement, hunger, and lack of health care due to the Zionist war are disproportionately affecting women. They claim that even their dignity has been lost. And for that reason, they will never forget and they will take revenge for these violations and the misery they are in just because of the Zionist regime. Hoda Hejazi, Gaza, Palestine.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. Please stay tuned.
If we as Muslims want to boost our economy, our production and our markets, we must have confidence in our heart and soul. Confidence brings honor and dignity. One good way to have dignity is to act as an ummah or community. Ummah is known by its deeds. One important deed is to establish salat and pay the zakat. Through salat and zakat and other righteous deeds, we can establish confidence in a society too.
The holy imams of Shia have always emphasized on establishing salat on time up to an extent that all the people around the world know the Shias by prayer on time. Also the Muslims, especially the Shias, can have their independent markets through Islamic markets. Confidence brings steadfastness and trust. And trust is the key to success. One good example is the halal market around the world. Muslims all around the world trust such markets because they know that the whole mechanism of such markets is Islamic. Therefore, having trust in Allah and having confidence in our hearts as Muslims paves the way to develop in both worldly and otherworldly affairs.
ف Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qarati. To find out more about this program, please log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
The Limelight.
U.S. spy agencies regard the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of FISA as one of their most valuable intelligence collection tools, but critics argue it intrudes on American public's privacy. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The English website of Qatar's Al Jazeera television network has covered this story. The US Senate has approved the extension of a controversial surveillance program, narrowly avoiding the program's midnight expiration. On Friday, 19th of April, the US Senate late-night vote, 60-34, re-implemented Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, after the House passed the measure recently. The reauthorization ensures the preservation of what advocates consider a crucial component of the United States' foreign intelligence collection effort. Section 702 of FISA, which was initially established in response to the 11th of September 2001 suspicious attacks in New York and Washington, allows U.S. intelligence agencies to conduct warrantless electronic surveillance of foreigners outside of the United States. U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said when voting on final passage began 15 minutes before the deadline, "In the nick of time, we are reauthorizing FISA right before it expires at midnight," adding, "All day long we persisted and we persisted in trying to reach a breakthrough, and in the end we have succeeded." Chuck Schumer claimed Democrats and Republicans came together and did the right thing for our country's safety. "We all know one thing, letting FISA expire would be dangerous. It's an important part of our national security to stop acts of terrorism, drug trafficking, and violent extremism. Both Republican and Democratic lawmakers have raised concerns about the alleged misuse of Section 702 of FISA, contending that it infringes upon the constitutional right to privacy of American citizens. The primary objective of this system is to oversee the exchange of emails and other forms of communication involving foreign nationals. However, it is possible that unintentionally messages from American citizens be intercepted if they are in contact with the individuals who are being monitored. Each year, hundreds of thousands of Americans' information is gathered during this process and subsequently accessed without a court warrant. The number of these searches has decreased from millions in previous years. Detractors label these searches as backdoor searches. The collection of information, which encompasses a significant amount of U.S. online activity, is designed to offer U.S. intelligence agencies expedited access to information concerning individuals from foreign nations. The legislation encountered opposition from House Republicans on three occasions within the last 5 months, resulting in its blockage. However, it eventually passed recently with a vote of 273 in favor, 147 against, after its duration was reduced from 5 years to 2 years. The program has garnered concerns from the White House, intelligence officials, and prominent members of the House Intelligence Committee regarding the dire consequences that may arise if it is not reauthorized. Despite constitutional protection, foreign nationals' privacy rights are compromised by the program, allowing data collection involving interactions with American citizens that can be accessed by domestic law enforcement agencies like the FBI without a court warrant, making it an intentional loophole for the government. A recent revelation says that the FBI employed this power to gather information on Black Lives Matter protesters, on donors to congressional campaigns and lawmakers in the United States, has increased doubts about the integrity of the program. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. The U.S. House of Representatives has voted in favor of a bill to renew the authority of a controversial surveillance program aimed at monitoring the electronic activities of individuals from other countries. The bill reauthorizing Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, was approved on Friday, 12th of April, by the House in a vote of 273 in favor, 147 against. The approval was granted following the alteration of the bill's duration from 5 years, as initially proposed, to 2 years, which was requested by certain Republicans. Section 702 of FISA allows U.S. intelligence agencies to conduct warrantless electronic surveillance of foreigners outside of the United States. Its sole purpose is to monitor email traffic and other communications of foreign citizens, but American messages may inadvertently be intercepted if they are in communication with the individuals under surveillance. FISA, which was first created in the aftermath of the 11th of September 2001 attacks, has drawn scrutiny from members of both the Democratic and Republican parties, as they contend that it infringes upon the constitutional right to privacy of American citizens. The program's failure to be reauthorized has been cautioned against by the White House, by intelligence chiefs and top lawmakers on the House Intelligence Committee due to the potential for catastrophic consequences. Last December, a senior White House official stressed the importance of Congress renewing the program, citing the ongoing conflict in the Gaza Strip and also the Russia-Ukraine war. as well as the high tensions with China and the persistent threat of cyber attacks, making it a dangerous time for any kind of unilateral disarmament. Also, U.S. Senator Ron Wyden has expressed serious concerns about the legality of a secretive phone surveillance program funded by the White House to track trillions of domestic phone records every year across the United States. According to a letter sent by U.S. Senator Ron Wyden to the Department of Justice recently, the Data Analytical Services Program has been collecting information from countless phone calls nationwide. The mass surveillance program, formerly called Hemisphere, allows officials to simply ask for phone records of not only criminal suspects, but also their spouses, children, parents, and friends. In the letter obtained by technology news site Wired, Senator Ron Wyden warned that troubling information had been received would justifiably outrage many Americans and other members of Congress. Senator Ron Wyden added, "While I have long defended the government's need to protect classified sources and methods, this surveillance program is not classified and its existence has already been acknowledged by the Department of Justice in federal courts of law." Hemisphere was first exposed in a New York Times report in 2013. At the time, it was understood that the program was used solely for drug-related investigations.
Sheikh Baghir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahruddin was.
When we say Divan of Hafiz is a book of Irfan.
Mawlavi claims that this Masnavi Ma'navi is the interpretation of the Quran.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction into the lives and thoughts of the most outstanding Muslim Shia dignitaries, personalities, and ulama. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio, I have two special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Rouhani and Shaykh Fadai. Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Shaykh Fadai, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about an outstanding Shiite faqih, a thinker, an alim, and a scholar. He is no one but Shahid Muhammad Baghir al-Sadr. You know, politically, socially, and religiously speaking, he was an outstanding man. He had so much positive effects in the mainstream studies of the Hausa of Iraq, and his political thoughts really helped very much in order to have a better understanding of an Islamic establishment or government. Shahid al-Sadr, through his book, was after a kind of, we can say, ideal or perfect Islamic land. I mean, it has its own independent system of thought, rulings, you know, and the role of the Muslim rulers are very much emphasized on that. What's your point regarding this?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, of course, the Shahid Sadr's ideas and viewpoints in this respect are really important and a kind of preparatory sort of ideas for the establishment of an Islamic system or government in the Islamic world, in the Islamic countries. case. For instance, according to Shiite scholars, the necessity for establishment of Hukuma al-Islamiyya, sometimes it is because of the riwayat and ayat. You know, some of these scholars are of the view that based on ayat and riwayat, you can prove the necessity of establishment of an Islamic government.
Yes.
But there are some other scholars who are of the view that no, maybe by the riwayat and ayat, we may not reach to the level of certainty that this kind of necessity is there, rather beyond ayat and riwayat, our nature, our fitra, our aql, our intellect and reason tells us that we have to establish such a system, certain Islamic and divine kind of system. So these are two main kind of viewpoints in this respect, but according to the Shaheed al-Sadr, Radwanullahi ta'ala alayh, he is of the view that the necessity for the establishment of an Islamic kind of government goes to the fitra of human, or to the nature of the human. Because of what? Because according to him, it is through only the establishment of an Islamic government and, let's say, political system,
yes,
that the nature of man would be actually, would be what we can say, grew up or improve and perfect it based on the Islamic doctrines and teachings. And then the Islamic civilization, which is the main objective of Islam and the religion of Islam, that only could be achieved via, yes, that Islamic system. So that's why, according to him, the reason for the establishment of such a system is fitra, or nature of man. And the other beautiful idea that is actually developed by the great Shaheed al-Sadr Ridwanullah ta'ala alayhi is this, the idea or the theory of haqq al-ta'a. This is very beautiful because, you know, whenever, according to this idea or theory, whenever you are in the status of doubt or skepticism regarding a specific action that you do not know whether you have to do this or not, and there is no any explicit kind of rulings in riwayat and ayat regarding that.
Yes.
So you do not have any ayah and riwayat to tell you that either you have to do this or not to do that. So in this kind of status, what should you do? According to Shaheed Assad, based on the principle of haqq al-ta'a, he is of the view that even if there is no ayah, no riwayat regarding an issue or let's say a kind of action that you want to act, if you think by your reason, by your intellect, if you think that probably there, for example, might be a kind of hukum, a kind of rule, divine rule, if you just probably or possibly you think that there is such a possibility,
yes,
in this case you have to be muhtat, you have to be cautious.
Cautious,
you have to perform the idea of, let's say...
So, and by you, this means the scholar? Or no, any ordinary...
By the scholars.
Scholars.
Even by the ordinary people. Uh-huh. If sometimes an ordinary person think that, okay, here, for example, I should observe this law, though I do not, I'm not sure that whether an ayat or ayat I have something, but my aql, my intellect, my reason tells me that here you have to, for example, not to do this thing.
Okay.
You know, here, he says that, of course, you have to fulfill haqq al-ta'a, but the very interesting part of his idea is this, that despite the fact that he... principially or theoretically he is of such a view, but he says that since in riwayat and ahadith we are told that we have to fulfill the aslul bara'a. Aslul bara'a means that in such a cases that you are not sure, you are in the status of skepticism, then here there is no need to, mm-hmm, to observe that.
Yes.
You have to fulfill aslul bara'a. He says since ayat and riwayat tells us that we have to fulfill aslul bara'a, I am committed to the aslul bara'a.
Okay.
While theoretically and rationally, I'm of the view that haqq al-ta'a should be performed here.
That's
so
right.
These are all the ideas that paved
the
ground.
New thoughts and ideas.
And that paved right. the ground, okay, for the establishment of a kind of Islamic ruling and system.
Ruling and system.
Yes.
That's all right. Okay.
Sheikh Muhammad Al-Hilli talks about Shaheed Sadr.
There's a lot of dispute out there today amongst historians and especially scholars as to what was the theory, the Islamic political theory, espoused by Sayyid al-Shaheed al-Sadr. And if you, of course, look at his writings, you'll come to the conclusion that he proposed an understanding from the Quran based on the system or the belief in Shahada, that there needs to be a major role played by the jurist, by the faqih. But of course, you study the life of Sayyidina Shahid and his ruling and his writings, and it seems, and Allah knows best, that this slight transformation and his opinions tend to slightly change towards the end of his life. There's no doubt that Sayyidina Shahid was inspired by the Islamic revolution in Iran. In fact, nobody today disagrees that when the revolution occurred, Sayyidina Shahid said, لَقَدْ تَحَقَّقَتْ حُلُمُ الْأَنْبِيَاءِ, that the dream, the goal of the prophets have been fulfilled. And of course, he famously said regarding the following of Imam al-Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, ذُوبُوا فِي الْإِمَامِ الْخُمَيْنِ كَمَا ذَابَ هُوَ فِي الْإِسْلَامِ, that surround yourselves, dissolve yourselves in the personality of Imam al-Khomeini, in that sense, just like how he has done this when it comes to the religion of Islam. And in fact, he was ready to become a wakil, despite the fact of being a marja' al-taqlid, he was happy to become the representative of Imam al-Khomeini in one of the provinces or cities in Iraq, to that extent that he was inspired by the Islamic revolution. But of course, when you read the book Al-Islam Yaqudul Hayat, he points to this idea that the scholar has an important role to play in governorship, and certainly he rejects any notion of secularist type of government. But what is now being suggested, of course, is that he was very much in favor of the theory of Wilayat al-Faqih in its absolute sense, because every scholar believes in the theory of Wilayat al-Faqih, but some believe in its limited capabilities, and others say no, that the Wali al-Faqih has the complete authority over the affairs of the community, so to speak, and the Muslim Ummah. He perhaps, and we cannot be absolutely conclusive, because of course at the tender age of 45 he was martyred, yet he was progressing and very much inspired by the thoughts of Imam al-Khomeini, but within the context that he believed that a scholar must act within the frameworks of the Sharia, but with the involvement of the people.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah.
And politically he was very much active, Shaykh Fadai, isn't it? I mean, during that time, I think the Ba'ath regime was very much active in Iraq, and he struggled very much against the Ba'ath regime and their extremist ideas. That's, it got it to his martyrdom, isn't it?
Yes. At that time, in the time of Saddam Hussein, there was a party, Hezbollah Ba'ath, the Ba'ath party.
Yes.
Of course, it was just called Hezb and
yes.
party. It was just a dictatorship.
Yes.
At that time, Shahid al-Sadr had a fatwa, because he was a marja, a lot of people followed him. He had a fatwa that joining the party of Ba'ath is haram.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was a danger for Saddam Hussein and his party. And they arrested him and his sister, Shahida bint al-Huda.
Yes.
And it is interesting that in the prison, there were some situations for him in order to be free. Mm-hmm. They told him, if you take back your fatwa that you said joining the Hizb of Ba'ath, party of Ba'ath is haram, and then vice versa, if you give a fatwa that joining Hizb al-Da'wah was a party that was formed by Shahid Sadr and some
yes.
of his friends, like Ayatollah Mohsen Hakim.
Yes.
They ask him to give a fatwa that joining,
against Hezbollah Da'wah in support of Hezbollah.
Okay.
Yes.
And then the third condition was that you shouldn't confirm the Islamic revolution of Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Because Shahid Saad was in the side of Imam Khomeini. They
yes.
have a very close idea about
yes.
Velayat al-Faqih, about the Islamic statement.
Mm-hmm.
By accepting these three conditions, he could be free.
Mm-hmm.
But he never accepted that.
Yes.
And because of that, he and his sister were killed.
Shahid
ibn al-Huda,
that's
right. And we talked about Imam Khomeini. I want to say that when some of his students were in Iran, because they were under the oppression in Iraq,
yes.
a lot of his students went to Iran and they mm-hmm. were studying in Iran in the Hawza Ilmi of Qom. Once he wrote a letter to his students in Iran, and that was the time of Imam Khomeini, the beginning of Islamic revolution of Iran at that time. And he had a letter to his students, and in that letter he conferred Islamic revolution of Iran and advised his student to back this revolution completely.
Yes.
And there was that famous sentence, ذُوبُ فِي الْإِمَامِ الْخُمَيْنِي كَمَا ذَابَهُ فِي الْإِسْلَامِ.
Yes.
You know, it is not possible to translate ذُوب
yeah. yes.
in English.
Yes.
But we can say, try to be completely focused on Imam Khomeini, not anyone else, because he is completely focused in Islam.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So, you know, when we see this relationship, Imam Khomeini was a marja, and he was a marja as well.
Yes.
It means that selfishness was not important for these kind of scholars in Islam.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to get their goal. The goal was Islamic statement and government against secularism,
yes.
against the government of Taghut. He tried a lot in Iraq, and of course he tried a lot in Iran by his students, and that was the reason of his martyrdom. But we can see nowadays, we can see that killing him was not successful for his enemies,
okay.
because he is alive by his ideas
yes,
and books.
And thoughts, that's right. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Fadai and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the life account of Shahid Muhammad Baghir Thad. He was assassinated and killed on April 5th, 1980. As you said, his body was taken in secret, you know, it's better to say cemetery or burial place, and that's all right. But in 1427, according to the Hijra calendar, his body and his grave was again taken into the entrance of the holy city of Najaf. Today is the visiting place of so many of the visitors from all across the world. May Allah bless the soul of Shahid Sayyid Muhammad Baghir Asad and Shahid Bintul Huda Asad. It was very kind of you, Sheikh Fadai and Sheikh Rouhani, and thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parsfield.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: the death toll from the Israeli genocide in Gaza tops 34,300 as the regime's airstrikes and artillery fire keep pounding the besieged territory. Israeli forces carry out fresh violent raids in the occupied West Bank, killing a Palestinian teenager in Ramallah. And U.S. police attack students.